I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI.
And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. Listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right.
It's been almost 3,000 years, and Greek mythology has proved that it is not going anywhere. But it can be difficult to find entertaining and engaging retellings of these myths that aren't fictionalized. Lucky for you, I'm here. Let's Talk About Myths, Baby is the Greek mythology and ancient history podcast of your dreams. I dive into the convoluted and confusing ancient sources so you don't have to. Listen to Let's Talk About Myths, Baby on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Oh, hi, I'm Rachel Zoe, and my podcast, Climbing in Heels, is back and better than ever. You might know me from the Rachel Zoe Project, or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. Climbing in Heels is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women, and this season is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to Across Generations, where the voices of Black women unite. I'm your host, Tiffany Cross.
Tiffany Cross.
Join me and be a part of sisterhood, friendship, wisdom, and laughter. We gather a seasoned elder, myself as the middle generation, and a vibrant young soul for engaging intergenerational conversations. Prepare to engage or hear perspectives that literally no one else has had. Listen to Across Generations podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind, a production of iHeartRadio.
Hey, welcome to Weird House Cinema. This is Rob Lamb.
And this is Joe McCormick. And today we're going to be talking about the 1983 sci-fi fantasy adventure Krull. And while I'm sure we've done a movie that fits into this category before, one of the main things that stuck out to me about Krull, at least as a film project, is that it has the overwhelming aroma of a troubled big-budget production. This is a movie that really excels in many domains, especially domains where money can make a lot of difference in a production, but also has major issues. This movie is a very mixed bag. Some elements are so genuinely wonderful in more or less the way they're intended to be. Some are kind of dull, maybe even boring sometimes. Others are extremely unintentionally funny. And on top of that, it's called Krull. You really cannot beat the phonetics of the name. And it all comes together into a preposterous, beautiful, disorganized explosion at the Star Wars factory kind of movie.
Yeah. There's a lot of wonderful weirdness in this one. It's going to be fun to discuss. One note about the title. I don't know about everyone else out there, but I've seen Krull multiple times over the years, and I frequently find myself having that moment in between viewings where I wonder, well, wait, what was Krull? And then I have to remind myself, oh, Krull is the planet. With two suns. Because other times I'll be like, is the monster named Krull? The monster on the poster? Is the magical weapon the Krull? Is Krull that guy with the scruffy beard that's the hero? No, it's the planet. It's like if you titled any movie that takes place on Earth. So instead of Cool Hand Luke, it's just Earth.
Yeah, I always think Krull is the monster. Because it looks like the correct name for like the fish face, critter that's keeping the princess hostage.
Yeah, it would work. It would be like, and in days of yore, the Krull came to our world. But no, yes. It's the beast, and the beast is in the Black Fortress, and the weapon is the glaive, and our hero is Clown, right? It's not Clown.
But Colwyn.
Colwyn. But it always looks on the screen. Ooh. And in text like it's spelled almost like Clown.
This movie has such an ineffective hero. Every time the hero is talking, when Rachel and I were watching it, we just sort of started making sounds. You're like, murp, murp, murp.
I don't know. I I would slightly disagree on some of his heroic moments, but we'll get to those. Okay.
No, that's fair enough. If you're a clown fan, I won't spoil your fun. But okay, so I mentioned earlier, it's kind of an explosion at the Star Wars factory. I think to reference a review that I was reading, a contemporaneous review from published in Variety in 1982, you could also call it an explosion simultaneously at the Star Wars factory and the Excalibur factory, because yeah. This review said, quote, "Although inoffensively designed only to please the senses and appeal to one's whimsical sense of adventure, Krall nevertheless comes off as a blatantly derivative hodgepodge of Excalibur meets Star Wars. Lavishly mounted at a reported cost of $27 million, a collection of action set pieces never gels into an absorbing narrative." And it's funny because there's not really anything in that paragraph I can disagree with, even though I love Krull.
Yeah, like this is correct, but it also is a very fun movie and one that I've seen many times over the years. So yeah, I keep coming back to it. Something works in this, and it's become a cult classic for this reason.
Yeah. So the Variety review, like many others at the time, makes note of the enormous budget. This was $27 million in, 1982-83 dollars. Mm-hmm. And that is one of the curious things about Krull. This is not the Brain Eaters. We're not watching a Roger Corman production made on the cheap. So I don't think any failures of the film can be chalked up to lack of resources or lack of ability to realize the director's vision or something. This is a luxuriously realized, almost one wants to say gilded film with mm-hmm. gorgeous location shots. You know, they've got all those scenes set with like the jagged peaks of the Italian mountains, just beautiful, wonderful cavernous indoor sets, including, my favorite, the thing that has a place in my heart, built indoor sets of forests, misty, magical, fake forests.
Yeah, these are great. In fact, I'm less into the movie when they're actually outdoors, but when they're indoors and they're on like an obvious but extremely well-executed indoor swamp or indoor forest or whatever the case may be, I'm all in.
Yeah, so you got all that jolly weird set pieces, costumes, characters, and yet I do think I have to agree with the review that Krull does not really work as a story. It's almost as if the main characters and their motivation are kind of like placeholders that somebody put in an early draft of a script to kind of build a world around, but then they never came back and replaced them and filled in the drama. Some occasional exceptions emerge, like I can think of a couple of really nice dialogue-driven scenes here and there. Like one is a scene where the hero Colin persuades some rowdy bandits to join his quest. For some reason, suddenly I think the writing's a lot better in that scene.
Yes, I think this was my first viewing of Krull that was completely solo. In the past, I've always watched this with at least one other person, if not a group of people, and there's a lot of talking over it and all. So this was the first time I really got to appreciate the sequence in question, which has a number of terrific actors we'll get to in a minute, and just has some nice back-and-forth dialogue. And I'm like, yeah, this is a solid scene. I like everything about this.
But meanwhile, some of the other scenes, just like the kind of exposition of the quest scenes are, I don't know. I mean, like, I love them, but they do not have a really believable element of human drama or character.
I think I saw a user review somewhere. This might have been on Letterboxd, where someone was like, "Yeah, this movie. The plot is a first time Dungeon Master's campaign."
Yes,
and I can I think that's a fair comment. You know, because you get that various feeling of, okay, these characters now meet these characters. These characters send the characters here. Now they have to go here, and then eventually they're going to face the big bad. And it has a simple structure like that, and it almost feels like, yeah, of course I'm not going to describe the characters. That's for the players to do. So that's why some of the major characters are kind of empty vessels in some respects.
Yeah. I think some of the semantic content of this film is just a skeleton upon which to drape the meat of the movie, and the meat is a buffet of delicious sets and set pieces, mountains, hillsides, swamps, built indoor forests. The meat, of course, is the beast. The meat is Alan Armstrong. Yes. And most of all, I would say the meat is the glaive. How can you not love the glaive? Because we really cannot discuss Krull any further without devoting a serious explainer to the glaive. Once you see Krull, every time you close your eyes, you'll see the glaive. The glaive is just part of you now. It is like a golden five-fingered starfish with knives jutting out of each arm. And it is referred to with such solemnity. It's just wonderful.
Yeah, the glaive is awesome. The glaive is kind of, I see about four different elements coming into play here. It's pretty much directly stated that the glaive is like an important sacred symbol that is now in physical weapon form. It is there's a little bit of sort of Eastern design to it as well. It's reminiscent of the shuriken that are attributed to Japanese martial arts for the most part. There's also a little bit of South Asian flair to it. It reminds one of the chakram weapon, a spinning blade weapon.
I looked it up on Etsy, and there are sellers who appear to have created glaive fidget spinners, which is just perfect.
That's great. Now, of course, it's also a magical weapon, and in this movie, anything magical might also be possibly technological, so it also reminds me a lot of the flying silver balls of death from the Phantasm movies, in the sense that it doesn't really have to behave in a way that makes sense from a physics or aerodynamics point of view.
No, it's like a flying starfish circular saw that you control with telekinesis.
Right.
I'm still thinking about that comment you cited that it's a first-time Dungeon Masters campaign. That is so perfect. Because I would say one of the main reasons for that is that the connections from set piece to set piece are very flimsy. It's just always like, well, we have to go here now. And that gets you to the next scene that you wanted to show. But could you explain why they were going from one thing to another? I think it's rare that you could.
Credit where credit's due. The exact one-sentence review for this from Letterboxd from someone with the username Cinema Void writes, "It's like watching a first-time DM test running a campaign of a level 2 party searching for a +5 fidget spinner to fight a space goblin." So,
fidget spinner, there you go.
Yeah. A bit harsh, but fair. They only gave it 1.5 stars. I would give it 5 glaives. 5 glaives, easy.
You would sacrifice all 5 of your fingers in the process of giving it 5 glaives.
All right. Well, let's get to the elevator pitch here. I would just give it a brief one. I would say it's Dungeons and Lasers.
That's a great tagline. Rob, I feel like I have been, at least lately, forgetting that the elevator pitch is actually supposed to be a straightforward description of the movie.
I want it to be.
Yeah, okay. I've forgotten that lately, and so this time I remembered that. I was like, oh, wait, okay, so let me try to do that, just so you understand what we're talking about. So, an evil mountain arrives from space, and it settles down on the world of Krull. Krull, again, is the name of the planet. And from this evil space mountain pour forth the Slayers, who are laser-blasting shock troops who terrorize the peaceful villages of this magical planet. In response, two kingdoms of Krull plan to unite by joining in marriage the heirs to their thrones, and these are Prince Colwyn and Princess Lyssa. But before they can get all their act together, Princess Lyssa is kidnapped by the Beast, the vile ruler of the Space Mountain. Can Colwyn save the princess? Probably.
Yeah, he has a really good shot at pulling that off. All right, well, let's go ahead and listen to some trailer audio here.
On a distant planet, a great kingdom was ravaged by beings who came from the future to conquer the universe.
Colwyn!
Now, the only survivors follow a doubtful seer and a throneless king.
They will hold her in the Black Fortress. You must have help.
At the end of an impossible journey, they must fight an invincible enemy.
Here's the knowledge you seek.
I shall be your king.
Columbia Pictures presents a world apart from anything you have seen before. Crawl.
See, sounds pretty delightful. It sounds like a big budget 80s swashbuckling fantasy sci-fi adventure.
With a James Horner score.
Yeah. As we'll discuss, this is a James Horner score for sure. So it's not my favorite score in the world. It's not my favorite James Horner score, but it's pretty good. It's pretty solid. It does everything it needs to do.
It's not my favorite either, but it has that majesty, all the kind of like fluttering brass of the mm-hmm. orchestra always kind of, every other scene sounds like a coronation hymn.
Yes. All right. When it comes to availability for this film, well, it's widely available. I think we both watched it on HBO Max, so it's available there, at least for now, until they take it down. They seem to be changing things around a lot over there. But as of right now, they still have a lot of good films in the collection. Krull has also been released in various Blu-rays, DVD, VHS, of course, and special editions over the years. There's even a VHS-style Blu-ray that came out that really captures the original awesomeness of the VHS tape, which I fondly remember seeing on the shelves at VHS rental stores when I was a kid, because it ultimately looks super scary. I think I was a little afraid of this VHS box because you see our heroes in the foreground, and in the background they've merged the Beast and the Black Fortress together, and it's just absolutely horrifying. He's staring right into my soul with his blood red eyes.
Yeah, the mountain is the Beast's face. That does not happen in the movie. But I also like, is this a real picture of the VHS box? Is that tagline right?
I think so. I think this is an accurate recreation of the VHS box.
Okay, well then, I just have to share. It says, "Journey into a mystical time where a horrible beast is the ruler." I feel like somebody could have put some more effort into that.
Yeah, maybe so. Now, coming back to what we've been talking about with the basic plot of Krull versus the overall visual style of it, I think that's ultimately where Krull excels, via its sets, via its costumes. By all accounts, the genesis of this film was a studio desire for a big fantasy film. And I mm-hmm. think originally it was going to be a lot more traditional, in that the Beast wasn't going to be a space titan. He was going to be a dragon. But it changed over time. And clearly, folks were brought in to just really breathe a great deal of visual life into this piece. It's almost like they gave some extremely talented people a coloring book or a paint-by-numbers sort of a thing. And they're like, this is the movie we're making. Do what you can with it. And boy, did they ever. Like, every little corner of the coloring book is just colored in with pigments you wouldn't expect or didn't expect or didn't know existed. And it makes it delightful. Like, some of the choices they make, it's like, for instance, it's not merely an Earth-like planet. No, it's a planet with two suns. It's not a dragon. It's a space titan. It doesn't live in just a cavern or a castle. It lives in a space mountain that came from down from the heavens. There's not a magic sword. There's a magic glaive. And yeah, everything has this wonderful weird sheen to it, and there are fabulous weird details that are not explained at all, and that's something I love in a film like this.
I agree. It's very much a genre mashup. Is this sci-fi or is this fantasy? It doesn't commit either way. It's just pulling in whatever seems cool in any given scene.
Now, we were also enjoying the detail that there was a video game adaptation of Krull. It was available in the arcades and on a home Atari system.
So, first of all, I think this is a pretty good-looking game, given its context. But also, the main thing I love about it is the sound effects. It has these chip-generated sound effects that are just... Ooh, there's a sound that it makes when your little Colwyn sprite picks up an item, like when it grabs a piece of the glaive. It's so good. I wonder if we could even sample that sound effect. Can't you just imagine that sound playing anytime you like pick up a dish to put it in the dishwasher?
Yeah, it's so perfectly muddy and glitchy and fun. I have to say, too, looking at not merely the arcade cabinet for this, which, of course, many of these arcade cabinets look terrific, but just looking at stills from the arcade game, at least, I was impressed by how much it actually looked like the film it was based on. Like, I could look at the details and be like, oh, those are the Slayers. Okay, that's the Beast running around. That's clearly the glaive being thrown about. So, unlike, I can think of other examples where you look at screenshots from these older games, and you're like, really? That's supposed to be E.T.? That's Indiana Jones? I don't know.
I'm going to say, in the poster for the game, Colwyn looks right. The artist successfully rendered this guy. But Princess Lyssa here, they gave her a spherical haircut.
Yeah, and she has like some really deep eyeshadow. I don't remember if she ever ended up looking like this in the movie, but she looks like she has decided to wed the Beast. Like, she looks like the princess in peril in Legend, after she has decided that she will marry, or she's been sort of ensorcelled into dancing around with the villain in that. Was he also called the Beast? I can't remember what his name was.
Is he just called Evil or something?
Darkness, I think. Yes, Darkness. Darkness, yeah. Yes.
Tim Curry,
and about 1,000 pounds of latex and so forth. Shout out to Astapro for sponsoring this episode and providing us with free samples.
Rob, as the local host with allergies here, they sent you some of their nasal spray to treat your allergies. What was your experience like?
Yeah, that's right. I always wrestle with the pollen a bit when it rolls in during the spring. So they sent me the little nasal spray. I tried out the product, and yeah, it sure did help me get on top of my symptoms for the day. And it's so fast acting, it was already kicking in before I left the house.
Astapro is a first-of-its-kind nasal allergy spray. It's the fastest 24-hour over-the-counter allergy spray. It starts working in 30 minutes, while other allergy sprays take hours. Astapro is the first and only 24-hour steroid-free allergy spray. Astapro delivers full prescription-strength indoor and outdoor allergy relief from nasal congestion, runny and itchy nose, and sneezing.
Get fast-acting nasal allergy symptom relief with Astapro. Go to astaproallergy.com for a discount so you can get Astapro and go today. Astepro allergy.com. Astapro and go. Uses directed for relief of nasal congestion, runny nose, sneezing, and itchy nose due to allergies.
Who hasn't heard names like Achilles or Odysseus, Cassandra, Medusa? But how much do you know about them from the ancient world? Let's Talk About Myths, Baby is the podcast bringing the ancient sources to life. Greek myth and history is timeless, and unless you've been living under a rock, you have seen just how true that is today. But there is so much more to these characters and stories than what pop culture can do justice. I'm Liv Albert, the host of Let's Talk About Myths, Baby, and every week I bring you stories from the ancient world, both mythological and historical, to breathe new life into these thousands of years old stories. I'm also regularly joined by some of the most brilliant names in the field of archaeology and ancient history, authors of your favorite retellings from today, and everyone in between. Join me as I dive into the wild world of the ancient Greeks and their stories. Listen to Let's Talk About Myths, Baby on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Bring a little optimism into your life with The Bright Side, a new kind of daily podcast from Hello Sunshine, hosted by me, Danielle Robey,
and me, Simone Boyce. Every weekday, we're bringing you conversations about culture, the latest trends, inspiration, and so much more.
Thank you for taking the light, and you're going to shine it all over the world, and it makes me really happy.
I never imagined that I would get the chance to carry this honor and help be a part of this legacy.
Listen to The Bright Side on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search The Bright Side.
I never thought I'd take my three young kids to Sicily to solve a century-old mystery. But that's what I'm doing in my new podcast, The Sicilian Inheritance. Join us as we travel thousands of miles on the beautiful and crazy island of Sicily, as I trace my roots back through a mystery for the ages and untangle clues within my family's origin story, which has morphed like a game of telephone through the generations. Was our family matriarch killed in a land deal gone wrong? Or was it by the Sicilian mafia? A lover's quarrel? Or was she, as my father believed, a witch? Listen to The Sicilian Inheritance on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, let's do those connections.
Yeah, we have quite a selection of talented individuals involved here. I think I can safely say for none of them was this their finest work. Well, for a couple of them, this might have been their biggest film. But for the most part, we have several individuals who had done greater things before would go on to greater things. At the top here, we have the director, Peter Yates, who lived 1929 through 2011, British TV and film director, probably best known for 1968's Bullet, starring Steve McQueen, Jacqueline Bisset, and Robert Vaughn, featuring one of, if not the best car chases ever committed to film.
I actually have not seen Bullet. I know it's famous for the car chase. Also, I did not realize Robert Vaughn was in it, who was in Battle Beyond the Stars. We talked extensively about Robert Vaughn's career as a guy in lawyer commercials.
Yeah, he has a pretty prominent role in Bullet, as I recall. It's been a long time since I've seen it, but it's a classic. Yates also directed 1977's The Deep, based on the novel of the same name about double shipwrecks and barracudas from Peter Benchley. And that starred Jacqueline Bisset, Nick Nolte, Robert Shaw, and Louis Gossett Jr.
I've always wanted to see that one, but I haven't.
Yeah, it looks very, it's very wet. Looking film. It's like they're going for one shipwreck, but there's another shipwreck underneath it. Like they're going for the heroin shipwreck, but that is on top, it turns out, on top of like a Spanish galleon or something that has a bunch of gold in it. And then I think they're barracudas. But again, I haven't seen it or read it myself.
Not sharks, barracudas this time.
Yeah. Now, Yates also directed 1992's The Year of the Comet, 1983's The Dresser, starring Albert Finney, two-time Academy Award nominee for The Dresser, and also for 1979's Breaking Away. So you have a talented director here helming this thing, though I think if you look at his other films, like this is the only one that's really kind of a big-budget genre piece. So I think he was branching out and trying something new here.
Yeah, I read somewhere that he sort of looked at this as an amusing challenge. Like, this is not somebody who's otherwise going to be making fantasy films. He's like, well, I wonder if I could do it.
Yeah. Now, the writer on this, or at least the writer, I don't recall the history on the screenplay exactly, but our final credited writer who gets all the credit is Stanford Sherman. Dates unknown on Stanford here, but he's a screenwriter who wrote for such shows as TV shows as The Man from U.N.C.L.E. and the 1960s Batman series, multiple episodes of that. His film screenplays include Krull, The Man Who Wasn't There, which is a Steve Guttenberg Invisible Man movie, and 1984's The Ice Pirates.
Oh, okay. So The Man Who Wasn't There, not the Coen Brothers movie.
Right. This is a Steve Guttenberg Invisible Man movie. I believe it is a comedy, but you know, all the best to the Goot, but I'm not in a big hurry to watch this movie.
Oh, but you mentioned Ice Pirates. That's something people have told us to cover on Weird House.
Yeah, I'd have to. I only have vague memories of watching Ice Pirates. I can't remember how inappropriate it is. So that's one of those that will require a review first.
Okay.
All right, let's get into the wonderful cast for this film. Starting, though, with the star playing Colin, which, again, it's really hard not to say clown reading this name, but played by Ken Marshall, who was born 1950, an American Juilliard-trained actor, active from 1979 through 2003. He may also be familiar to some of our listeners as Lieutenant Commander Michael Eddington on Deep Space Nine. I'm a little foggy on these episodes, but I think he's like a traitor to the Federation who ends up joining up with the, ragtag group of civilizations that had like the shape changer, the changeling species in it, and some other creatures.
Oh, okay.
He also played Marco Polo in a 1983 miniseries and also appeared in the 1988 movie Feds. I have to say, like, I agree he's not maybe the best in this, but I feel like in those scenes that have good, well-written dialogue, and he's also surrounded by often an incredible group of more talented, more experienced actors, I found that I bought his charismatic, raising everybody up, getting everybody united, his little speeches and so forth. I bought into that. So at least some of the time, I find that he works pretty well on screen.
Oh, sure. I mean, I was making a little bit of fun, but also he is fun in the role. Like, I would not replace Ken Marshall here.
Right. All right. His love interest, of course, is Princess Lisa. Is it Lisa?
Lyssa, I think.
Lyssa, L-Y-S-S-A, played by Lisette Anthony. British actor known for such titles as 1995's Dracula, Dead and Loving It, 1992's Husbands and Wives, and the 1991 reboot of Dark Shadows. She also appears in the Anton Corbin music video for the solid Depeche Mode song I Feel For You. I don't really remember this music video, but it's a solid track. It's not one of the Depeche Mode tracks that annoys me. She also did an episode of Tales from the Crypt, Forever Ambergris. This is an episode that had Roger Daltrey and Steve Buscemi in it. And she's a kidnapped princess in this movie. So her performance hits all the expected notes for that kind of a role. And I also was reading that her voice was apparently dubbed in the final cut. So we have to take that into account.
I was noticing that in nearly every scene, there's a bit of a twinkle in her eye. Like she's almost on the edge of playing it for comedy. I sense an awareness of the campiness of the movie that a little bit comes through on the screen. Like, I mean this not in an insulting way. She plays the role almost as if she's playing kind of like a princess in an SNL sketch.
Yeah. I think it is the right tone for this because, like you say, it bordering on comedy without actually venturing into that territory, without actually subverting the film or the role to any extent. I can see that twinkle. All right. Well, you can't have a story like this without a wizard in it. And actually, we have multiple wizards in this film, but we have at least one who really knows what he's doing.
I bet you also didn't think you'd get a Dune crossover in Krull.
Oh, yeah. We got at least a couple of them here. This is the character, and I'm blanking on how we pronounce this one. It's Y-N-Y-R. So Ynir?
Ynir, I think.
Ynir, yeah.
Ynir.
Ynir, yes, a kind of wizard and seer and just general wise dude. He's putting the party together. He's the one who shows up after stuff goes poorly and says, "All right, we need to solve this beast problem." Played by the wonderful Freddie Jones, who lived 1927 through 2019, and yeah, he's a real treat in this. He's got a strong screen presence. He's one of, I think, the central grounding performances in the film. Every scene he's in, he breathes a sort of seriousness and life into it. The Dune crossover, of course, is that he played Thufir Hawat in David Lynch's 1984 adaptation of Dune. He was also in Lynch's 1980 film, The Elephant Man. He did a lot of TV work. He also had memorable roles in such films as 85's Young Sherlock Holmes, 1984's Firestarter, the 1982 Clint Eastwood fighter jet SR-71 movie Firefox, and 1979's Zulu Dawn.
What would you call his facial hairstyle in this, in Krull?
I don't know what the exact name for this. It's like a mustache that goes down and becomes two beardlets on either side. And the great thing, I included this for you, Joe, is if you put his character in Krull next to his character in Dune, it basically looks like his beard pieces were subsequently removed after the filming of Krull and pasted on his eyebrows for yes. the character in Dune.
It's just a face bristle inversion.
Yeah.
I was thinking of the two parts of his beard as lobes, like his beard has two lobes, like the lobes of a brain. And I don't know. I can't think of anywhere else I've seen this.
Anyway, he's great. Like I say, anytime he's on screen, he's got a very loud presence that I think works really well. Really fills up those big, huge sets in a way that a lot of performances don't. And this character also has a love interest of sorts, as we'll discuss, the Widow of the Web, played by Francesca Annis, born 1945, English actor known for her roles as Lady Jessica in David Lynch's Dune from 1984. Mm. So there's our other Dune connection. She was Lily in the 1978 miniseries of the same name. She was Lady Macbeth in that pretty great 1971 adaptation starring John Finch. That was long one of my favorite Macbeth adaptations. And anyway, she's been very active in film, TV, and theater over the years and was active as recently as 2020.
She plays a nice tragic role in this.
Mm-hmm.
But you know what else you didn't think you were going to get in Krull? Is the Green Bay's vampire.
Yeah. I had, for the most part, I forgot he was in this. I think all subsequent viewings of Krull came before I really appreciated the awesomeness of Alan Armstrong, who plays a a bandit, an axe-wielding bandit ruler who answers to no man and wears a spiked choker around his neck so that nobody can strangle him. This is the 37-year-old Alan Armstrong, born 1946. We've talked about him here before on the show. He was, of course, in the 1992 Split Second, but we mainly discussed him in our episode on the brilliant 1985 snooker musical Billy the Kid and the Green Bay's Vampire.
I have to point out that the Wikipedia page for Krull describes his character in Krull, Torquil, as, quote, a man who favors an axe and is a leader of a group of bandits. You know you've really made an impression when the first thing they say about you is that you favor an axe.
He does always have a super shiny axe on him. But this is a great role. This is especially for Alan Armstrong, who has, you know, is a great character actor, doesn't always have a really central staying role in a picture. But in this, he has a lot of screen time. He's an interesting character that actually has more of a character arc than some of the other characters in the film. Like, he goes through changes. He's there's this sort of what are we in this for as bandits? Do we just want to steal emeralds and make off? Do we care about the future of the world of Krull? So really, I think Torquil here there's a lot more going on with him compared to some of the other characters.
Torquil's great. Alan Armstrong, he just has unwashed charm for days. Absolutely. Yep. Brilliant.
Yeah, this is another one of the performances that I think really cements the picture.
You know what else I actually thought was a pretty good performance is the comic relief character, Ergo.
Yeah, Ergo, the wizard, he seems to mainly specialize in transmutation spells. That's pretty much all we see him doing. Trying to turn people into animals and failing, trying to turn himself into the right animal and failing, finally pulling through in the end. But played by David Batley, who lived 1935 through 2003. And he has that sort of Eric Idle, Nigel Planner manner and physicality to him that works really well for a comedic performance and a comedic presence. And he mostly did comedic roles on stage and screen.
As soon as he showed up, Rachel was like, he's in Charlie and the Chocolate Factory.
Yeah. He plays a character named Mr. Turkentine. I haven't seen this Willy Wonka in a bit, so I don't recall exactly how he factors into the stories of the doomed children.
Rachel thought he was a teacher in a school.
Ah, that would make sense.
So I guess that would be the beginning of the movie. I'm not sure.
Yeah, outside of those two big films, those were the two big films, I think, for this guy. He mostly did TV, and especially after Krull, it was mostly television.
You may already get the sense that we're meeting a lot of characters in this movie, but it just keeps going, right?
Yeah, because we also have a Cyclops, a memorable cinematic Cyclops, played by Bernard Breslau, who lived 1934 through 1993, a towering 6'7" British actor. In this, playing a cursed Cyclops with second sight and a weird trident weapon. This actor, I've seen him in at least one other thing. He has a really fun goon role in the delicious 1969, I think it's a Hammer production, a groovy space movie called Moon 02. And he was also had roles in the Carry On movies in Britain and also 1977's Jabberwocky.
I have to say that I think, unfortunately, the Cyclops in this movie is not a great creature design, at least not in the way they intended, but I loved every time the Cyclops showed up because he looked so amazingly humorous. Like, they make the Cyclops very placid and awkward and stiff in his movements, and I was wondering, why is he like that? Why is he so placid and awkward? And then I realized it's because, well, he's not really getting to act with much of his real face, and he can't see. He can't see in his costume, so his movements are necessarily very constricted, and the effect of all this put together oddly made me keep thinking of him as Trumpy and Pod People.
Yeah, this brings me back to a discussion we had in our episode on Metal Storm, The Destruction of Jared Sin, because that movie, of course, has some Cyclops characters in it, and they created the Cyclops effect by deciding, okay, we're going to have a mutation type thing going on where one eye of the actor is obscured and only one eye of the face is in use, which
gives it a unique look, but also allows the actor to see and to act through their own facial expressions to a degree that Bernard here was not permitted to do. So yeah, you put somebody in what I think is still ultimately a pretty good Cyclops costume, but there are just severe limitations by putting that effect in place on someone.
If you watch it again with this in mind, that like the actor couldn't see, it makes a lot more sense when you see the way he moves. Like that, it always looks so funny the way he kind of like is very constrained in the way he kind of rotates his body in order to do things. And I think it's because he's trying to be careful not to run into or trip over things.
Yeah. I mean, it's one of the limitations of the Cyclops design. This is why to this day, one of the best and most memorable, if not the best, Cyclops effect is Ray Harryhausen's stop motion Cyclops creature. And I can't even remember which film it's from, but I think if you're listening to this, you probably can picture it in your mind. Mm-hmm. All right. Well, let's get into some of the other actors here. This is a lesser bandit character in the film that still has kind of a story arc to him, a character arc to him. And this is Keegan, played by Liam Neeson.
Oh boy, Liam Neeson is, you know, you can see his star power shining through, even though this is a small role. Mm-hmm. He plays a bandit who, the main thing we know about him is that he's a horrible two-timer who has like nine different wives who don't know about each other.
That's right. Yeah, there's not much to go on here. And yet, yeah, he's basically, you know, physically he's a big guy. So he's playing this kind of hulking brute of a bandit, but he's got a twinkle in his eye. And yeah, the Neeson magic is able to shine through a bit here, even though it's a bit part. And I don't imagine I need to say any more about Liam Neeson. You know Liam Neeson, now mostly known as in his post-Taken career as an older action star. But yeah, and then he had the whole series of films there, you know, Schindler's List. But even before Schindler's List, he was in like two movies that I've always loved. He was in the 1986 film The Mission. Not a huge part in that, but memorable. And of course, he's the lead in 1990's Darkman, which was a tremendously fun film at the time.
Even in Krull, he has a particular set of skills, but those skills are favoring an axe and cheating on his wives.
Yes, that's true. All right, let's get into some of these other characters in the party. This enormous party. I mean, really, this would just wear any dungeon master out. Some of these have to be non-player characters.
How many characters are we at now? We're not even doing all of them. We're just
yeah.
Okay, but we got to have at some point. They're like, how are we going to figure out where the fortress is? Because it teleports every day. Well, we need a seer, right?
Yeah,
you got to have a seer.
So that means they go to a seer by the name of Seer, I believe, or he's credited as such. And this is played by John Welsh, who lived 1914 through 1985, longtime British TV actor who also appeared in such films as 1970's Cromwell, 1970's The Man Who Haunted Himself, and a very small part in Charles B. Pierce's 1978 Viking movie, The Norseman.
Whoa.
Yeah, I haven't seen that one yet. But Charles B. Pierce, of course, gave us the Boggy Creek movies and a Viking saga.
Gave us that as a gift.
Yes, yes. He gave, these are cinematic gifts that he bestowed upon the world.
Wasn't Boggy Creek 2 one of like the, I don't know, like second or third movies we did on Weird House?
Yeah, I think it was. It was pretty early on. But that was a fun one. That one starred Charles B. Pierce. Remember that? That's a Charles B. Pierce tour de force.
Written, directed, and starring. Can't beat that trio.
All right, we have another bandit here. We have Run, played by the great Robbie Coltrane, born 1950.
Robbie Coltrane, I know him.
Yeah. Probably best known for his role as Hagrid in the Harry Potter movies. We, of course, also had a memorable run in the James Bond franchise. In Britain, he was on TV's Cracker. Other roles include parts in Van Helsing, From Hell, Henry V, and a very bit role. You know, I was surprised to see this in 1980's Flash Gordon. He is Man at Airfield in that. So I don't think that is a major role.
In this movie, he has a really funny moment when he gets killed while they're assaulting the fortress, the beast's fortress at the end. And after he gets shot by the slayers, everybody has to run over to him so they can listen to him give a death monologue. But then it's just like, the journey was worth it.
Yeah, I think I'd read that his voice was apparently dubbed in the final cut of this movie as well. And
oh man, what a mess.
All right. So the cast also, there are other folks involved in this. I don't think we even hit everybody in the party, but moving on to some of the behind the scenes stuff. We already mentioned James Horner, who lived 53 through 2015, a composer known for scores such as Battle Beyond the Stars, but also Aliens, Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan, Willow, Field of Dreams, many more. I think Avatar was one of his final, if not his final score. And his 1986 score to The Name of the Rose remains one of my favorites. Certainly one of my favorites, my favorite James Horner score, but also just one of my favorite scores in general. I feel like he really pulled that one off. This one, as we've said, is more of a traditional 80s fantasy fanfare adventure score. All right, looking to some more behind the scenes stuff here. The director of photography was Peter Szoszewski, born in 1941, Polish-born cinematographer who is well known for his work with David Cronenberg on such films as Dead Ringers and Naked Lunch, but also various other Cronenberg films. He also worked on The Rocky Horror Picture Show, Mars Attacks, and a little picture by the name of The Empire Strikes Back. Production designer on this was Stephen Grimes, 1927 through 1988, award-winning production designer known for Out of Africa and Never Say Never Again from 85 and 83, respectively, among many others. And then I also noticed that an art direction credit goes to Tony Curtis, not that Tony Curtis, but the production designer, art designer, Tony Curtis, who lived 37 through 2021, who did a lot of like 70s Amicus horror movies and also worked on the snake movie Venom from 1981 that we previously discussed.
Who hasn't heard names like Achilles or Odysseus, Cassandra, Medusa? But how much do you know about them from the ancient world? Let's Talk About Myths, Baby is the podcast bringing the ancient sources to life. Greek myth and history is timeless, and unless you've been living under a rock, you have seen just how true that is today. But there is so much more to these characters and stories than what pop culture can do justice. I'm Liv Albert, the host of Let's Talk About Myths, Baby, and every week I bring you stories from the ancient world, both mythological and historical, to breathe new life into these thousands of years old stories. I'm also regularly joined by some of the most brilliant names in the field of archaeology and ancient history, authors of your favorite retellings from today, and everyone in between. Join me as I dive into the wild world of the ancient Greeks and their stories. Listen to Let's Talk About Myths, Baby on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Bring a little optimism into your life with The Bright Side, a new kind of daily podcast from Hello Sunshine, hosted by me, Danielle Robey,
and me, Simone Boyce. Every weekday, we're bringing you conversations about culture, the latest trends, inspiration, and so much more.
Thank you for taking the light, and you're going to shine it all over the world, and it makes me really happy.
I never imagined that I would get the chance to carry this honor and help be a part of this legacy.
Listen to The Bright Side on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search The Bright Side.
Hello. From Wonder Media Network, I'm Jenny Kaplan, host of Womanica, a daily podcast that introduces you to the fascinating lives of women history has forgotten. This month, we're bringing you the stories of disappearing acts. There's the 17th century fraudster who convinced men she was a German princess, the 1950s folk singer who literally drove off into the sunset and was never heard from again, the First Nations activist whose kidnapping and murder ignited decades of discourse about Indigenous women's disappearances, and the young daughter of a Russian czar whose legendary escape led to even more intrigue and speculation. These stories make us consider what it means to disappear and why a woman might even want to make herself scarce. Listen to Womanica on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Season 9 of Next Question with me, Katie Couric. It is 2024. And we're going to get through this together, folks. My campaign promise to all of you here on Next Question is going to be a good time the whole time, we hope. I have some big news to share with you in our season premiere featuring Kris Jenner, who's got some words of wisdom for me on being a good grandmother, or in her case, a good lovey.
You know, you start thinking of what you want your grandmother name to be. Like, are they going to call me grandma like I called my grandmother? So I got to choose my name, which is now Lovey.
I'll also be joined by Hillary Clinton, Renee Fleming, Liz Cheney, to name a few. So come on in and take a break from the incessant negativity for a weekly dose of fascinating conversations. Some of them, I promise, will actually put you in a good mood.
I loved it. Your energy and joy.
I'm squeezing every minute I can for you out of this season of Next Question.
Last question, I promise. You have to go. I have to go. But it's been so fun.
And I can't wait for you to hear it. Listen to Next Question with me, Katie Couric, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
So at this point, all the playing pieces are on the table. It's time to crawl. It's time to crawl down on some crawl.
All right. I know this is the most overdone physics pedant thing to point out in a movie. I don't usually mention it these days, but I thought it was funny by virtue of its prominence. The very first thing that happens in this movie is a depiction of sound in outer space. So there's a vast field of stars in the void, and the orchestra's, you know, pumping out the kind of coronation overture, you know, that James Horner music with like a weird boys choir ooing and aahing. It's almost kind of you can't always get what you want. And then we see a glaive. We see this golden starfish whirling through space toward the camera, and the glaive is, so it's whirling like, you know, the rotor blades on a helicopter, and it's making helicopter sounds, like swishing sounds. Mm-hmm. But not only is it sound in space, the sound is directly what would be a result of the little starfish finger knives swishing through the air. Now, you might say, oh, but this is a terrestrial fantasy film. But not exactly, because the next thing we see is something flying through space. The villain's fortress slash mountain is also a spaceship.
Yeah, the Black Fortress. And really, this film comes out swinging in terms of just like weird stuff that's going to makes you ask a lot of questions. Because, yeah, here comes this mountain, and it has this structure in it. And we see more and more of this throughout the film. But I love the design of this because it is essentially an evil castle. It is the film's evil castle where the evil big bad lives. But it defies easy categorization beyond that because it is also a spaceship. It's also an asteroid. It's like it's geologic. It feels like it is formed through geology and erosion, but it also feels, especially when you get into the occupied portions of it, it feels like it was grown, like the whole interior castle was extruded by some sort of strange space mollusk.
Yeah, on the outside, a lot of the texture we see is columnar basalt, but then when we go inside, a lot of the stuff looks like I don't know, that kind of like rigid mucus architecture made by the creatures in Aliens.
Yeah, except but cleaner and well lit.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah, or it's like a lot of times you feel like you're inside a textbook illustration of an ear canal.
That's right. So the mountain from space gently settles down on the surface of this planet very slowly, and yet the surface just explodes anyway when it does. It looks like it's settling down in the sand hills of Nebraska. And we better make friends with Space Mountain because it's going to be a major set piece in the movie. You will see it over and over. And immediately we get some voiceover narration. So I think this is the voice of Ymir?
Yes. This is Freddie Jones.
Ymir, yeah. Mm-hmm. Ymir starts saying, we haven't met him yet, so we don't know who he is. It's just voiceover. This it was given to me to know that many worlds have been enslaved by the Beast and his army, the Slayers. And this too was given to me to know that the Beast would come to our world, to the world of Krull, and his black fortress would be seen in the land. The smoke of burning villages would darken the sky, and the cries of the dying echo through deserted valleys. And meanwhile, we see the Slayers for the first time. Rob, how would you describe the Slayers?
Oh boy, this is the one of the things that I think a lot about, trying to figure out the Slayers, because the Slayers here, they have this kind of black armor that is at once it kind of feels like some sort of an evil suit of armor from fantasy, but it also feels kind of like a spacesuit, also kind of like an exoskeleton. They have these staffs which can be used as a melee weapon, but also
can shoot laser beams like this. Mm-hmm. So there's clearly some high technology here. They come from another world. They ride horses, though. They ride horses into battle. Again, they shoot laser beams. And we also come to find out that if you kill one, they emit a high-pitched squeal. They crackle with red electricity. Their heads explode. A kind of like bloody space weasel comes out of their head and then burrows into the ground, and then other pieces of their body kind of self-bury as well. You have no idea. There's no explanation exactly what's going on here, but it's thoroughly magical and otherworldly and alien, and so it absolutely works.
Yes, I love the Jason Goes to Hell thing here, where they each have it. So the helmet thing explodes, the bloody alien slug tongue comes out and then like burrows down into the ground. Mm-hmm. And the way I interpreted that, did you get the same thing? That like what the Slayer actually is the tongue, it's the alien slug. And that the rest of the body is just like a suit that the tongue operates. It's like Krang in the body.
Yeah, I think that would make sense. It's either that or it's like a humanoid body that has been repurposed and armored. Because this is the other weird thing about it. So this introduction again, which I'm assuming it's the voice of Vanir who we meet later. He's talking about the prophecy was that the beast would come, but then later we hear that like the beast has been here for a very long time. Long enough that the Cyclopses that we encounter, like he has like his kind has a generational issue with the beast. Like he was cursed by the beast and his people ages ago. So he's been here for a while trying to conquer the world of Krull, and he has these slayers, which may or may not be entirely off-world in origin, or they might be some sort of it might be a situation where they're like, okay, go capture us some more humanoids so we can turn them into slayers. We just don't know. We're left to fill in the blanks on our own, which, again, is something I love to do in movies like this. The slayers present an enigma.
Yes, all of that is true. Okay, but I got sidetracked from Ynir's narration here because he's not done. He's going to talk some more. He says, but one thing I cannot know, because remember, he's been telling us all the things that have been given to him to know. Mm-hmm. He says, one thing I cannot know, whether the prophecy be true, that a girl of ancient name shall become queen, that she shall choose a king, and that together they shall rule our world, and that their son shall rule the galaxy. We're getting into some Dune territory here.
Yeah, I mean, some of that be true. We know that it be true because it ultimately happens in the film. Some of this, I don't know, the whole thing about the prophecy of the child and the galaxy, there might have been a mistranslation when he was given to know this.
We don't even see them have a son. Spoiler, there's no son in the movie at all. So we don't even know if the son will rule Krull, let alone a galaxy.
Right. This is another, the scale of the saga here of the war between the kingdoms of Krull and the beast. I have a lot of questions about this as well, because we never see an enormous force of slayers, and we come to know later on, it is given us to know that the Black Fortress, even though it arrived via a descent from orbit, it moves around regularly by just teleporting from one place to another, never the same place mm-hmm. twice. So you never know where it's going to be. So this keeps a largely medieval civilization from mounting a proper siege against the Black Fortress. And it allows the Black Fortress to essentially carry out small raids. Like they don't have that many slayers, but they have good horses apparently, and they have laser weapons. So they seems like they can be highly effective in surprise strikes. But ultimately, how it seems like they've been here on Krull for a long time. They haven't conquered the whole planet yet. Supposedly they're working up to it, but it seems like a tall order given what the beast has at his disposal. We have no idea like what the map looks like, what uh-huh. does beast territory look like versus these other kingdoms. We have to fill in all these blanks. So I just have a hard time imagining like, well, what does conquered territory look like? How does he hold territory? Is it just like, I would love to know, what does a conquered region look like? Is it people going about their normal business, but having to like like harvest corn for the beast or build a space laser that points at a planet they've never heard of.
Does he have beast puppet rulers that he leaves behind? And do they look like him? Do they have like the fish teeth and stuff?
Yeah, or do they just absolutely destroy everybody and turn all the humans they find into slayers? Is it a Borg situation? We have no idea. This is why we need a Krull series to take all of this and stitch together, a 6-season story.
All right, so in the castle, we're here in a castle with a princess now, because remember we heard about a girl of ancient name. She's going to become queen. And so we see her in a castle, and this castle is full of guards wearing plastic armor with glossy paint that looks kind of like mid-priced Iron Man costumes.
Yes. But
also with more, not total body coverage, just like the actual armor part is more kind of shoulders and then bikini. So it's almost like sexy Iron Man costume.
This too, the look in the castle, of course, looks like a castle, but is also immaculate. So this also made me thinking about the possible sci-fi connections, because the castle looks like it was 3D printed by like a colony barge or some sort of a spaceship that visited the planet Krull. The traditional armor of the kingdom here, it looks like some sort of sci-fi space armor or it's the memory of sci-fi space armor reproduced for a medieval level technology culture. So it's strange to try and figure this out. Like, who are the people of Krull? Are they themselves aliens that came here maybe not too long before the beast arrived? What is going on here?
I also have thoughts on the decor of the castle here, because again, this is not the evil castle from space. This is the nice castle where the princess lives. Mm-hmm. The doors here look like they have dartboards on them. And I couldn't help but keep noticing this feature that are these random metal torture chairs just like sitting up against the wall in these big empty rooms where no one would ever sit. And later we see the chairs repeatedly. Like, I don't think anybody ever sits in them, but we see when like a fight breaks out later, the chair is getting kicked over. But okay, we got to meet characters. So we got a princess, we got a king. A princess seems melancholy at first, but I think she's just waiting for her prince to arrive. And he's on the way. This is going to be Prince Colwyn. She's going to marry him, and she's very excited. But her father is weirdly disapproving, even though he has explicitly authorized this marriage. But he's making comments like, he's too handsome and confident and too great a warrior. I think the implication is like, wouldn't you rather marry a nice, scheming Machiavellian backstabber? Mm-hmm. But their marriage is going to be some kind of political arrangement, right? Like, each one has a daddy who is a king, and the two daddies have agreed to join the forces of their kingdoms by marrying their kids together.
Right. It's like it's Romeo and Juliet, except it's about to work. It's about to actually, they're about to pull it off, and the fathers are like, okay, all right, it's fine. You can bring peace to our family, and we'll reunite. We'll unite our forces, and we'll join forces against the beast and save our world. Okay, kids.
Mm-hmm. And it's also, to be clear, not like a miserable political marriage. Fortunately, it seems like Lyssa and Colwyn are just really into each other.
Right.
And I wanted to highlight one thing here in the castle, which is that usually, as we were saying earlier, the sets and locations in this movie are very beautiful. Occasionally, there's one that just looks pretty hokey. And I would single out the set where where Colwyn and his people arrive at the castle, and there's like a dude, I don't know, captain of the guard or something, standing at the top of a staircase. It looks very fake. It looks thrown together. Like, it doesn't look like stone. It looks like a wooden staircase that was painted over to look like stone and that kind of thing.
But it looks like you could swashbuckle all over the place here. And that's the
important thing. Will. They will. And so the prince and the princess have a marriage ceremony. They're surrounded by all the Iron Mans. And Princess Lyssa pulls fire out of a bowl of water and hands it to the prince. And this is their traditional Krull-style marriage. But the marriage is... The wedding is interrupted when slayers show up. Slayers ride in, they bust down the doors of the castle, and they attack the wedding. And I would say this is a scene where the mixed bagginess of the movie really emerges, because there are some shots in this attack sequence that are very scary and effective. Like, there's a great creepy looking scene where the Slayers, with some kind of apparent anti-gravity magic, are climbing up the walls to go into the castle. But then there are other shots that are so bad, like, some of the fight choreography in this section is especially humorous, very phoned in, people just kind of half-heartedly jiggling swords at each other.
Yeah, now don't look too closely at that that special anti-gravity technology that the Slayers are using, because the string becomes visible at times, yeah. Which you can't blame it too much. This reminds me of... I follow Todd Masters on Instagram, who's an effects guy who's been working in effects for ages. And I remember seeing some thread he had going there with some other effects guys. And they were talking about, yeah, remember the days when you could just count on some VHS grime to cover up the details of an effect? You know, like, a lot of these were not put together thinking you would ever view them at the same, in the same picture quality that, you know, we're reviewing them in our homes now.
Yeah.
Still, I'm nitpicking here. The Slayers still look nice and creepy scaling up that wall.
Yes, they do. But again, I mean, if you actually like stop and try to watch any of the fights, like any of the people trading blows here, some of them, they're barely trying.
Yeah, yeah. The fight choreography here is not amazing. There's swashbuckling to be had here. There's a lot of jumping around. You get the sense of a battle, but maybe not those the details and the nuance that you would associate with like a great fight scene, great sword fighting or anything.
Yeah. Anyway, big effect of this whole sequence is the princess is kidnapped by the Slayers and taken back to the Black Fortress. And everybody else but Colwyn is killed. And then Colwyn's left there. He's wounded. He's lying on the staircase. He's distraught. Everybody's dead. And Colwyn is then revived by Ynir, this guy, Freddie Jones here, who introduces himself. He's like, I am Ynir. And Colwyn's like, oh, the old one. And he's like, I'm not old. But he says, you know, you've come down from the Granite Mountains. So Colwyn knows who he is. This guy's a famous, I don't know, prophet or magician or wise man of some kind. He says he's needed now. And Colwyn starts crying about his father being dead. Though unfortunately, it really looks like he's laughing in the scene where he's supposed to be crying.
Yeah, he's, it's hard to figure out exactly what's going on.
But he gets a charge from Ynir. Ynir's like, stop crying. You have to go rescue the princess and defeat the beast. But first you have to get a glaive. So here begins our adventure. And from here on out, it's just stringing together one set piece to the next.
Mm-hmm.
So we get a truly beautiful sequence where Colwyn has to go retrieve a glaive from the top of a mountain. And I think this was shot in mountains in Italy, but we get all these craggy peaks and jagged mountaintops, and Colwyn's climbing up them to get to the cave, to get to the glaive cave. But meanwhile, we're treated to all these vistas. This is a great looking sequence. Eventually, he comes up to the cave and has to stick his arm into what looks like molten lava in order to retrieve the glaive. And it's covered in mud, like caked on mud or something. And it kind of crackles off. And then underneath, the brilliance of the glaive shines through. And he's very excited.
I like that he has to do something to get the weapon. You know, yeah. Like you have to pull the weapon from the burning fire. It reminds me in the recent film... The Northman. Is it The Northman or The Norseman?
The Northman, yeah.
The Northman, okay. Not The Norseman. That was the film we referenced earlier. In The Northman, there's a scene where he gets a sword, and he has to, at least in his own mind, fight some sort of an undead wraith in order to claim it. It feels better when there's a trial that has to be overcome to get the weapon, as opposed to, like, say, Thrilling Bloody Sword, where our main hero... He does have to do some swimming, but then when he gets there, the skeleton's like, hey, do you want my armor and this sword? It's really good stuff. Let me tell you how it works. And he's like, yeah, I would love it. That's why I swam here. And then he takes off with it. And there's no trial to overcome.
That's funny. I didn't compare that scene in Thrilling Bloody Sword to the one in The Northman, but they are kind of similar. They both have to like go down into a mound or some kind of cavern to get the weapon. But yeah, in The Northman, he has to fight a draugr.
I guess in Conan the Barbarian, he doesn't actually fight a skeleton, but he's at least, he has to deal with the wild dogs or wolves that have cornered him in the crypt, and he has to accept the sword, go out, and kill some dogs. So at least there's that. Or wolves, not dogs. They're wolves.
Oh, okay. Here we get a moment where there's some, I think, very convenient writing to restrict the amount of special effects that are going to have to happen in the movie. Mm-hmm. Because Ynir says to Cole, and he's like, hey, you can't just use the glaive now. You got to wait until it's time. And he's like, how will I know when it's time? And Ynir's like, well, it's when it's in the final act of the movie and you're facing the bad guy.
This is not a weapon you get to bust out for encounters leading up to the final fight.
I think he says, you will know when it's time.
Who hasn't heard names like Achilles or Odysseus, Cassandra, Medusa? But how much do you know about them from the ancient world? Let's Talk About Myths, Baby is the podcast bringing the ancient sources to life. Greek myth and history is timeless, and unless you've been living under a rock, you have seen just how true that is today. But there is so much more to these characters and stories than what pop culture can do justice. I'm Liv Albert, the host of Let's Talk About Myths, Baby, and every week I bring you stories from the ancient world, both mythological and historical, to breathe new life into these thousands of years old stories. I'm also regularly joined by some of the most brilliant names in the field of archaeology and ancient history, authors of your favorite retellings from today, and everyone in between. Join me as I dive into the wild world of the ancient Greeks and their stories. Listen to Let's Talk About Myths, Baby on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Bring a little optimism into your life with The Bright Side, a new kind of daily podcast from Hello Sunshine, hosted by me, Danielle Robay,
and me, Simone Boyce. Every weekday, we're bringing you conversations about culture, the latest trends, inspiration, and so much more.
Thank you for taking the light, and you're going to shine it all over the world, and it makes me really happy.
I never imagined that I would get the chance to carry this honor and help be a part of this legacy.
Listen to The Bright Side on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search The Bright Side.
MTV's official Challenge podcast is back for another season.
And guess what? So are we.
Just in case you forgot, I'm Tori Deal. I'm a six-time finalist and a Challenge champion.
And I'm Anissa Ferrer, and I've been gracing your screens for the last two decades. I am a veteran challenger and Challenge All-Star.
And speaking of All-Stars, All-Stars 4 is finally here.
I'm going to be honest. I literally thought this day was never going to come.
Well, the Challenge gods have answered our prayers, and we're going to be right here along with you fans covering every episode on the podcast.
And this season takes it to a whole new level. Old school legends, modern power players, redemption seekers, and ex-lovers are all competing in Cape Town, South Africa for the prize of $300,000.
Anyone can win, relationships matter, and only one all-star will claim the title of Challenge Champion.
Listen to MTV's official Challenge podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I never thought I'd take my three young kids to Sicily to solve a century-old mystery. But that's what I'm doing in my new podcast, The Sicilian Inheritance. Join us as we travel thousands of miles on the beautiful and crazy island of Sicily, as I trace my roots back through a mystery for the ages and untangle clues within my family's origin story, which has morphed like a game of telephone through the generations. Was our family matriarch killed in a land deal gone wrong? Or was it by the Sicilian mafia? A lover's quarrel? Or was she, as my father believed, a witch? Listen to The Sicilian Inheritance on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
But here we're going to recruit a bunch more characters. So we recruit Ergo the Magnificent. This is the comic relief character who's a sort of eccentric, incompetent magician who's always referencing spells to try to change other people into things, but instead ends up changing himself into things. He transforms himself into a goose in the first scene, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, goose. When the bandits show up, he's like, I'll turn the bandits into pigs, and he turns himself into a cute little piglet.
Oh yeah, so we meet the bandits. There, it's when our heroes, having recruited Ergo, by the way, sort of accidentally by way of Cyclops terror, like Ergo's like, no, 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 I'm not going with you. I'm going my own way. But then he just runs into a Cyclops,
yeah.
And then he's like, no, oh, okay, I'm with you. I'm with you now. But yeah, so the characters meet Torquil, that's Alan Armstrong, and the band of thieves. And it starts with the thieves trying to rob them, but then Colwyn, rather cleverly and charismatically, is able to make them join his cause. I think it's by saying, he's like, well, I'm the legitimate king now, so I can have all your crimes forgiven. And he demonstrates this by using the key that he has from his father's master at arms, I think, to unlock all of their manacles.
Yeah, but still, Alan Armstrong's character Torquil has to be convinced, because he's like, we're already free. We're already do what we want. Why should we come with you and go on this death mission with you? And yeah, basically our hero rolls a natural 20 on his persuasion and gives a nice speech. And they're like, finally, like other members of the bandit party, they break first and they're like, yeah, I think I'm with this guy. Like, this is a noble mission, fighting not only for ourselves, but fighting for our children, fighting for the future of our world. We'll join up with him. And finally, Alan Armstrong's like, all right, we'll see where this goes.
It's a solid huzzah all around.
Yeah.
So next there, I lose, again, as I said earlier, you kind of lose track of what exactly the reason for each of the next stops on the journey is, but they're going somewhere for some reason. I think they have to meet a seer in order for him to be able to tell them where the fortress is, but they're wandering around through a forest and they have another encounter with this Cyclops we saw earlier. I think the Cyclops sort of pivots out from behind a tree and throws a spear at a slayer in order to save the life of Ergo the Magnificent.
I believe that's right, yes.
And Ergo's all freaked out, but we get some backstory on the Cyclops. The Cyclopses, what's the plural? Cyclopes. The Cyclops is part of a member of a, you know, a group of Cyclopses that existed long before when the Slayers came to Krull in the ancient past, and they fought then, and ever since then, every Cyclops has a death grudge against Slayers, and he will attack Slayers on sight. So that's why the Cyclops has been helping them.
Yeah, and they are truly cursed with second sight, because they can see into the future, but they see only one thing. They see their death. They know where it will occur. They know when it will occur. And if they try to deviate from their fate, it will only ensure that their death is more painful, which always struck me. Like, that's one of the details in the film especially when I watched this when I was younger, I was like, oh, that's awful. That's so tragic.
How do you think that interacts with the actual Cyclops' death when we see it later? I was thinking that the demise of the Cyclops was very clumsy writing, because there's like a scene where he says, I can't go on with you because I know I'm about to die, so I'm going to die here. And then they leave. And then he immediately just follows after them and helps them do the next thing. And then he dies.
Yeah, it seems like there needed to be a bit more connective tissue. Like, there a moment where he realizes, no, they really need me. And even though it's going to totally mess up my noble death here, I've got to go and save them. And so then, yeah, he ends up sort of he's just kind of suddenly he's there with them, and I guess he kind of holds a door open for them, and then is subsequently crushed by that door and does die a horrible death.
Right. So, so we learn about the Cyclops, and then they collect the seer, and the seer also has like a little kid friend. And so they're part of the party. Now the seer is he's this blind old wizard. They're going to a place in the middle of a swamp where three trees grow together so that they can see where the fortress is going to teleport to next.
Oh, you have to remember the seer tries to, peek in to spy on the beast's whereabouts from his own abode. But then the beast like reaches through the magic with his six-fingered claw and stops the seer. So he's like, no, we can't do it from here. We have to go to a place where it's safe, where the beast can't like triangulate our location, or can't use some sort of a counter offense against us.
It's like a Sauron Palantir kind of thing. They have to find a place where somehow the Palantir Sauron can't see them through it.
Yeah.
And the place is the swamp. Now, Rob, I know you loved the swamp sequence. Do you want to describe it?
Yeah, it's. I thought it was really effective. Every time I've viewed it, it's pretty effective because we get the Slayer attack, and we were expecting Slayers to pop up again. So there's this fight. There's also a fabulous quicksand sequence. Characters get caught in wonderful cinematic quicksand, and you get the traditional shenanigans involving that. But then we realize the beast is so clever because this attack was really a distraction, because then we see the seer, who I think is supposed to be blind. He's standing there. He's kind of away from this. He's not going to be in the middle of this combat. He's standing off to the side. And then suddenly behind him is another seer. There's something that has taken on his form. And then it reaches out to him and like extends its claws and stabs into him. And like the actor playing the seer, he emits this horrible cry. I find everything with this changeling, as they later call it, this doppelganger creature that's been sent by the beast to replace the seer, it all comes off really creepy. It's always creeped me out anytime I've watched it. Something about watching this old man suffer, killed in solitude by this interloper while everyone's distracted over here with the battle in the quicksand.
Yeah, this part was creepy. And then, of course, the seer, I think, after this tries to kill Colwyn, the seer changeling.
Yeah, there's an attempt on his life, and then I believe it's the Cyclops that skewers him with his trident, and he emits this horrible screeching sound when he dies, and there's this kind of melting, imploding effect, and he also, his body kind of self-buries when it falls. We don't see a blood weasel come out of his head, but it's very evident that this was a creature of dark magic sent by the beast.
So, we're down a seer, and now it isn't going to do any good to go to these three trees in the swamp because we don't have a seer that can, look at the trees and figure out where the fortress is. So we have to go somewhere else, and Ynir has an idea, right? Ynir's like, I know, the Widow of the Web, she can tell us where the fortress is.
Yeah, and this becomes even more complicated because it's revealed that this is Ynir's ex as well. So they have a lot of history. There's a lot of baggage here. But also it makes it maybe a bit more possible as a solution because he has some sort of connection here. They're not going to just show up and be consumed by a monster.
Right. Oh, and we should mention on the way, I think it's before we get to here, that there's like a sweet interaction where the kid who was with the seer has been talking about how if he could only have one wish, he would want a puppy. Mm-hmm. And then ergo, the selfish, incompetent magician transforms himself into a puppy for the kid.
Oh, yeah. This was great. Because it's a very cute, like, basset hound puppy. It's adorable. And it's a much better... There's some wonderful clumsy moment earlier where the seer is clearly dead because we just saw the crumpled body of the doppelganger. And then the whole party comes around and the kid is like, he was my only family. And then Colwyn turns to him and says, we're your family now. And that's it. That's the entirety of their grief counseling here. So at least we have a puppy that is at least one of the characters turns himself into a puppy and lets the kid carry the puppy.
Earlier, their interaction, the kid had said if he could have one wish, he would want a puppy. And Ergo is like, "Why? Oh, that you're messing up. Why one puppy when you could wish for 100? And the kid says, I only want one. And Ergo just thinks this is stupid.
Yeah, I like that too. That's another one of these nice character interaction scenes.
But anyway, on to the Widow of the Web. So Ynir has to go on by himself because if more than one person approaches, the Widow of the Web will kill them all immediately. But if he goes alone, he might have a chance. And so everybody else hangs back behind. And this is where we get some nice conversation where like Liam Neeson explains about his 14 wives and some locals. Where did these like women come from when we see them hanging out with the bandits?
It's just one of those scenes where suddenly there are more people around, and at first you're like, "Oh, this party's bigger than I thought it was," and then you're like, "Oh no, these are different people, that like the people of the forest that they're hanging out with and getting a full rest so they can restore all their spell slots for the encounters ahead."
Right. And so, but at the, meanwhile, at the fortress, we get some interactions with the Beast and the princess, and the Beast is like, be my wife.
Yes.
And the princess is like, I don't want to. And he's like, let me show you what your prince is doing. And so he pulls up a TV screen pretty much for her to watch Colwyn here being seduced by a changeling who's pretending to be a woman here. Mm-hmm. And I think she's supposed to like make Colwyn look bad while the princess is watching and then kill him. But instead she's like, you know, oh, let me comfort you. And he's like, I will not accept comfort. And so he proves his virtue. He proves his faithfulness while the princess is watching him on TV. He's so good. The changeling is like, okay, well, I have to kill you now. But she's like, but you're so nice, I can't do it. And so, I mean, what more could you ask for? What a stand up guy.
Yeah, this is a very confusing scene.
Yeah,
it's a lot going on here.
But anyway, the princess is like, see how good my husband is. Now that's an additional reason why I'm not going to marry the Beast. But okay, so Ynir has to go talk to the Widow of the Web, who is like a sorceress who is trapped in a sphere in the middle of a giant cave surrounded by spider webs because there's a giant spider that lives in the cave. And as he approaches and tries to get to the sphere, the spider attacks, but he manages to make it through. And then he talks to the enchantress and they have a history together.
Yeah. And they talk about it for a while. There are a lot of ins and outs, a lot of tragedies. There's a deceased son in the mix. Like, it's a lot. And every time I watch it, I'm left not really having a full idea of exactly what their personal history is. But it's well acted, so I'm buying that the history is there and that they reach some sort of decision here. And it involves a magic hourglass, and he's given the sand from the hourglass. And this somehow helps him get back across the web. And there's that big stop-motion spider.
I think the deal is this. The spider would kill him as he was. So she is able to use her magic to tell him where the fortress is going to be. Mm-hmm. But he can't get back out to the mouth of the cave without the spider killing him. So she's like, I know. If you carry the sand from my hourglass in your hand, then the spider can't hurt you. But as soon as the sand falls out of your hand, you will die. So he's like, okay. So she breaks the hourglass. I think that kills her or dooms her in some way. And he gets the sand. He leaves. He makes it out. And then he gets back to his friends. He's like, the Black Fortress is in the desert. And then the sand pours out of his hand. And they're like, oh no, the desert. And he's dead.
It was a good ride, though. Good death.
But there's a problem, because how are we going to get to the desert? That's very far away. And I think it's the Cyclops that suggests, you know what we need? We need us some fire mares.
Yes, fire mares are the answer. So we've reached the part of the film here that that was my wife's favorite part of the film growing up. She grew up as a horse enthusiast. And so I think a lot of horse enthusiasts and viewers who were into horses when they were young, like, this is their favorite part, because we have, when they finally find these fire mares, these are played by Clydesdales. They are some truly beautiful horses. It's hard not to get pulled in by their equine majesty.
Yeah, and they literally, like, their hooves are on fire while they gallop through the sky. But they take them to the fortress. The Cyclops stays behind because he's like, no, it's my time now. I have to stay here and die. And so they go off to the fortress and they assault it. They start climbing up the sides of the Beast's fortress. And it kind of reminded me of the attack on the Riddler's Island at the end of Batman Forever, which I watched recently for an episode I did of Seth's music podcast, Rusty Needles Record Club, which, if you haven't checked that out, give it a listen.
Well, it's been a long time since I've seen Batman Forever, so you're going to have to describe the attack on Riddler's Island.
We were talking about it because we were talking about the Batman Forever soundtrack. Mm. But Riddler's Island in the end of this movie, Jim Carrey and Tommy Lee Jones are hanging out on essentially an island that is also the Aggro Crag from Guts. And Batman and Robin attack it by sea and by air, and eventually they just end up climbing up some very fake-looking rocks. And that's what this assault is like. They're climbing up some fake looking rocks while the slayers shoot lasers at them, and they're stuck. They're like, oh, what are we going to do? They're shooting lasers at us. It's not like they've been doing that the whole movie, but you know, they don't know how they're going to get past the lasers. And then they're saved by the Cyclops going back on his word, showing up on a fire mare and saying, I'll run up there. And he does.
Yeah, this is another part where I have to think about the nature of the beast power structure. So since the castle, the fortress here, since it teleports regularly, they never have to really invest too much in the defense of the fortress, because they're only going to be there a short amount of time. Nobody's going to be able to mount anything more than a quick rushed assault on the fortress. But still, they have the laser gun, so they're pretty adequate at defending it.
Yes, but with the help of the mighty Cyclops, they make their way in. And then his real death, unlike what he predicted earlier, is that, like you said, he's holding a couple of rocks apart until all of Colwyn's guys get through, and then he just sort of gives up and lets the rocks squash him.
Yeah.
But okay, so Colwyn and Torkoal's bandits and a couple of other people in the party, Ergo, and there's a lot of people, the kid, they all fight. They fight their way into the fortress. Inside, it's like a giant cave. It's got this big alien mucus bridge. They get sniped at by slayers. Liam Neeson has a death scene where, you know, I really wish his last line had been like, tell my 8 wives I didn't care about them. but I don't know. He says something else, and then he dies on the floor.
I like the detail that the slayers on the outside of the castle, the ones that go out in the field and battle, they have dark armor. But the ones on the inside of the castle, they have white armor. They're kind of like stormtrooper slayers. So it's a nice little tweaking of the design.
So there's a part where in the castle, Colwyn and the bandits come to a dead end. They come up against like a dome that they can't get through. And they know the princess is in there, but they think there's no way in, until Colwyn goes, there is one way. And what's it going to be? It's Glaven time.
It is Glaven time.
So the glaive turns into a floating, flying circular saw, and it cuts a hole in the wall of the princess's prison cell, but very slowly, giving us plenty of time, meanwhile, for the bandits to get trapped in another room, and a spike death for one of them named Bardolph. Like, spikes come out of the walls and start stabbing at them. But finally, the glaive cuts through the wall, and then there's a reunion. You know, the prince and the princess are together again. They embrace, and oh, it's so great. And Colwyn's ready to fight, but she... could you explain what this meant? She goes, you can't fight the beast here. You must fight him away from the center. I don't know what that means.
I don't know either. It's like you've got to fight him in another location. And so they do. And... yeah, the final battle ensues. And I have to say, the final battle has some real issues.
So yeah, this is not very good.
Yeah, the beast design, the creature design seems great. They don't show a lot of it, so maybe it wasn't that great, who knows. But from what we see of it, it looks pretty cool. It's this big, you know, black alien costume, this horrible mouth, big red eyes, weird tubes, the 6 fingers on the hand. I think the big problem is, though, that the beast is like 30 feet tall instead of a respectable 7. So
yeah,
it ends up feeling like our hero, Colin, is fighting a drive-in movie theater projection.
Yes.
We never feel like the beast occupies the same physical space with any other character in the film, at least not in his full-blown beast mode, his beast form, you know? Mm-hmm. So we end up with the whole battle is just kind of a battle of psychic and magical projectiles. Glaive is flying through the air. Beast is breathing fireballs or something. And, you know, it just doesn't feel like a battle. I don't feel the stakes at all here.
You know, but I always say a good fight scene needs, you know, it needs beats, it needs drama, it needs twists. And one twist here is that, you know, the glaive is very powerful. It's clearly a great weapon, but at some point it gets stuck in the beast. Uh-huh. And we see Colwyn trying to pull it out psychically. He's like reaching out and going, and the glaive will not get out of the beast's flesh. So, we're really in trouble now. But then Lyssa... she's like, Colwyn, it's not the glaive, it's you. And then he says, Lyssa, it's us. It's us he can't defeat. And he figures out that the woman he chooses as his wife needs to give him fire that will, she says, like, take the fire from my hand. And that somehow transforms Colwyn into a pyromancer. And now he can shoot fireballs out of his hands.
This would probably have been explained if we got to see the full wedding, like with the full vows, where it's do you promise to give your husband a magical fire that he may use against extraterrestrial threats? And you could say, I do, you know, that sort of thing.
With this fire that I got from my wife, I thee burn.
Yeah. And I kind of forgot about the whole thing with the fire in the ceremony we saw earlier. So even reviewing it, I'm like, what? What's this fire thing? What? This feels kind of out of left field, but I guess it was established. But still, it feels kind of weird and thrown on. And it's also another one of those, it turns out the weapon wasn't magic. You were the magic the whole time. The magic was love. Here's the love fire. Now go blast that beast.
Can you feel the love of Krull?
So at this point, he defeats the beast. The beast kind of blows up and stuff. And then the whole Black Fortress begins to fall apart. It's like any magical fortress in a film. Like stuff starts falling to pieces, kind of like the Castle of the Dark Crystal, how portions of it were falling apart. Except this time, the whole Black Fortress is crumbling. And then as we were having to get all the characters together, hey, find the wizard and get him up. Make sure he's not a tiger anymore. Because that's the other thing. You got to pull through and change into a tiger to kill some slayers. Let's find the kid. Let's see. Is anybody dying and need some last words? Nope. Okay, everybody's good. All right, everybody's living. Let's leave the castle. Let's leave the Black Fortress. And then as they actually leave the Black Fortress, we do get an awesome effect. The Black Fortress is not crumbling down. It's crumbling up. And the pieces are falling up into the sky and going up into outer space.
I love that.
Yeah, I dig it.
And then we get some nice happy stuff. I think Colwyn's like, hey, Alan Armstrong, why don't you be my vice president?
Yeah, Torquil is named Hand of the King. So, you know, good for Torquil. Solid get.
It's a very sweet and wholesome ending. And that does it for Krull.
Will their son rule the galaxy, though?
It not addressed. In fact, they even remind us at the end, almost like they were not hoping we would just forget about that because the movie doesn't deal with it. It's like, and as the prophecy said, they were wed and their son would rule the galaxy. But what's in the galaxy? We don't even see what any other planets look like.
I don't know. Yeah, I guess if I'm digging into this idea that the castle of the humans on Krull was built by a colony barge, then maybe there are other worlds out there that for some reason the human colonists there decided on a medieval structure to their civilization. And maybe there are multiple beast ships moving around trying to get them. Who knows? Saying we must prevent we must prevent these space medieval types from becoming space Renaissance types or something. I don't know.
The guild navigator arrives. The representative of the Landsrad disembarks. They come out and they say, sorry, Colwyn, Lyssa, you have been officially deposed by the Landsrad. This planet now belongs to the Harkonnens. Too bad.
Or they could go with the sort of a classic Outer Limits ending where, the beast's parents show up. And we realize that the beast was just a child of the species. And now they have to deal with the grown-ups with their full strength.
Okay, I think I can say no more about Krull.
Yeah, there's nothing left to be said, but go watch it if you haven't seen it before. And if you have seen it before, well, now's a great time to go rewatch Krull. Watch it with someone you love or by yourself. It's great. It's great both ways. All right, we're going to go ahead and close out this Weird House Cinema. But yeah, we'd love to hear from everyone out there if you have memories about watching Krull, if Krull is close to your heart, et cetera. Share your love for Krull with us. As always, if you want to see some blog posts about these movie selections, go to samudamusic.com. I blog about them there, and I include the video clip. I embed the podcast episode and so forth. And also, if you use Letterboxd, that's Letterboxd.com, we have a profile there, Weird House. Go there. You'll find a list of all the movies we've covered on Weird House Cinema. And sometimes there's a peek ahead to what we're covering in the future. So it's a nice visual way to see what we've looked at, what we've watched. And you can also throw in little tabulations there and see them by decade, see them in order that they were made, that sort of thing.
Huge thanks, as always, to our excellent audio producer, Seth Nicholas Johnson. If you would like to get in touch with us with feedback on this episode or any other, to suggest a topic for the future, or just to say hello, hello, you can email us at contact@stufftoblowyourmind.com.
Stuff to Blow Your Mind is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit visible.com.
I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI. And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. Listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right.
Oh, hi, I'm Rachel Zoe, and my podcast, Climbing in Heels, is back and better than ever. You might know me from the Rachel Zoe Project, or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. Climbing in Heels is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women, and this season is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
It's been almost 3,000 years, and Greek mythology has proved that it is not going anywhere. But it can be difficult to find entertaining and engaging retellings of these myths that aren't fictionalized. Lucky for you, I'm here. Let's Talk About Myths, Baby is the Greek mythology and ancient history podcast of your dreams. I dive into the convoluted and confusing ancient sources so you don't have to. Listen to Let's Talk About Myths, Baby on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.